What's going on, guys, and welcome back to this week's episode of the Let's Just Talk podcast. We have been planning this for a little while in the background, and I'm glad that we could finally get there. There'll be plenty of things that we'll talk about to why it took us a little bit of time to get it sorted, but I'm super excited to have you here, mate. I know this is how most people who follow me, I'm a sucker for reality TV. People know my love for this show. They've already heard Nat on the show in the past, and she's how we connected here. But Chef Dave, how are you, mate? Welcome to the show.
I'm good. Good morning. Well, good evening. Thanks for having me. I'm stoked we could get this going, finally.
We could. And I wanted to reach out to one because, as I said, I spoke to Nat quite a while ago now on the show. And when I said to her, I said, look, is there anyone else from the show that, you know, you could potentially reach out to that, you know, would, you know, want to come on and have a chat? And your name came first to the pile. She said, you know, you're a great guy and that you'd probably jump at the opportunity. And so I appreciate you for doing that for us, mate. But the thing that kind of really gravitated me towards really wanting this conversation with yourself is that how much you want to go into it. But on the show, I saw a real vulnerability from you and an openness and an honesty that is rare to find on reality shows these days. It always seems so kind of curated, and it seems, you know, people seem quite polished on it, but you seemed a very honest kind of human being, and then kind of going down the rabbit hole of who you are and what you're doing and some of the things I'd love to talk to you about with regards to the Everest trip that you did have planned. Yeah. And obviously we can talk more about that as well. You know, I really kind of got a sense that this is someone that, you know, takes their health, their mental health and the well-being of others, as well as being an honest kind of human being quite seriously. And so again, I'm really, really appreciative you've kind of, you know, sharing, I guess, your journey and everything you're going through, and I guess where we are today and what's going on.
Yeah, honestly, it was a mad journey. And obviously, I think it's so clear that, you know, people need, especially men's mental health, need to be vulnerable and show their vulnerability. This day and era, especially after COVID, you know, there's more and more suicide and people are so scared to speak out. And during the show, you know, it was a super tough time. I'm not used to the cameras following you around all the time, and I mean, having that breakdown on the show. I mean, the producers even came out and they were like, you know, we don't have to show this. So really, they were really supportive towards me, to be honest, which was awesome. I was like, what's the point of doing it? This is reality TV, right? This is real. This is how I'm feeling. I'm not wrapped around this toilet just for you guys. I needed to let it out. You know, I had to let it all out because I was hurting. And I think that's I've always struggled with it. Anxiety. I've had real struggles with depression growing up. It's really hard to put your finger on it. But the only thing that really kind of made it easy for me, not easy, made was kind of to counteract it, was doing extreme sports and being in an environment where I never stopped and never really sat down to just to put my feet up. I had to keep moving forwards, you know, and keep growing as a person and keep achieving. And that's kind of how I've got to where I am today, is just never stopped and kept moving and trying to keep positive. And even when you have those bad days, you know, where you feel like you can't talk to anyone, I feel like it's important. You have to, you know, you've always got someone that you can pick up the phone to and dial that number, or just shout out loud, you know, just scream, because it does get tough at times.
Is the profession that you're in, and you obviously just said there that, you know, you've always been involved in sport and kind of pushing yourself and things like that, but is the profession that you're in something that can lend dealing, or, you know, I guess experiencing issues around mental health and anxiety? Because I can only imagine that, you know, food is one of those things, especially in a profession that you're in, and a high level profession that you're in, being a private charter yacht kind of chef, or, you know, these kind of, you know, very high end type situations where the client, it's not like I'm just going down to the local pub and I get a Palmer and chips and I'm like, oh, this wasn't the best meal. I'm not going to really make too much fuss about it. But when you're kind of making these really incredible dishes and they're people who are paying a hell of a lot of money for it, if you're even off by even the slightest amount, I dare say people are probably going to have something about it, you know, to say about it. And here you are kind of pouring your heart and soul into the foods that you're making. I dare say that feedback can, I presume, get quite difficult at times.
No, absolutely. Like, there's so much passion and love that goes into it. And that's what I love about it, you know. It's real, like, I've definitely got, like, ADHD, so I put so much just love into everything that I'm doing. And if you do get bad feedback, you're definitely not sleeping, 100%. So it has a huge effect on it. And when you finish a busy service anyway, it's so hard to unwind. Hence, you get the typical drunken chef, you know, all the, like, what people kind of put towards a chef. It's just how, it's so hard to shut down and unwind, and it's almost impossible. But yeah, like you said, it's like there is so much pressure on yourself, come from the feedback and everything that you put into what you're doing. And I mean, I think there's a lot of chefs out there this day and age who just do it, just you know, it's just a job. But I mean, what's the point in doing it? For myself, and I could speak for a lot of others, you know, it's more than that. It's life. Honestly, I swear it keeps me on level par. Like, just that situation of being in a busy kitchen. So a lot of people would be like, hell. To me, it's like, I love it. You know, it's life. I absolutely adore it.
And so I guess that two-edged sword for you, I mean, as you said, you thrive in that kind of passion, that kind of pressure type environment. But it's also something that on the flip can actually kind of be the downfall kind of thing. Is that something that, yeah, from even a young kid, that you've always thrived in those kind of high pressure situations? And have you sought those kind of environments out, you know, growing up? Is kind of, where does that all stem from?
I started when I was growing up, I was two older brothers who were gnarly. And I was the younger brother, so they were either protecting me or beating me up, you know, one or the other. But I had a lot of issues, and I had a stint in a bit of a mental hospital at a young age, at the age of 10. My mum and dad tried everything to support me. I was just this angry, out-of-control kid. I was just, no one really understood me. So I had this stint in a hospital. I was on lots of Ritalin, which really didn't help me, but it was really tough. I was only 10 years of age, you know. But like, my mum really did try everything for me. In the end, it didn't work. I come out of that, and then long story short, I won't go into it too much. But I found cooking. I started washing dishes in a restaurant at the age of 13. I used to do it at the weekends and then Wednesday nights, and until I got to like 14, nearly 15, they offered me a job as an apprentice. So that's when I started cooking. And I always loved the ideas of you know, the chefs, big knives, these angry looking guys, they got to drink for free. It was like, wow, this is sick. And it was kind of like, that it kind of stemmed from there. And obviously, like, the restaurant life is so, so different to being on a boat. So when I was growing up and doing, I never stopped cooking. I've been cooking my whole life. A lot of the yacht chefs, you know, they join, they do a course and they're like, oh, I'm a chef. I've done the whole path. That's why I love it so much. But what I went in, what I'm trying to say is like, being in that restaurant life, it's such a different level to being on a boat surrounded by different people. There's banter, it's fun, you're taking the piss out of each other all the time. It's all these high stakes, it's super, super fun. And like you said, ups, downs, highs, lows. And it would always go out on the piss afterwards, which also ended in trouble. And it's kind of just this roller coaster. But that's kind of where it stemmed from, to be honest. But being in that kitchen, that in that environment, was always a leveling. It's a place where I always felt safe, even though it was pretty brutal at times.
And where did kind of, I guess, going into that kind of private world or that high end world of being on yachts and, you know, chartering big boats and things like that, was it just a quick step that you kind of came across, you know, you were touring Europe or something, you saw a yacht and like, oh, there, that looks pretty cool, and you kind of got into it like that? Or did you know something, like, how did you shift from kind of a restaurant world and then moving into that other world?
So when I was 18, I went to the Ritz, and then I worked for Ramsay and Claridge's, and that was my last stint in London. And then I was like, I've got to get out of here. A story for another time. I was kind of going into a place where I didn't really want to go into around my hometown. So I had to kind of get out of town. That was kind of my reasoning for it. So I got offered a job in a hotel in the French Alps. So I moved to the Alps. I never skied before. I never left my hometown. You know, this was super overwhelming for me. And this was what actually changed me as a person as well. It opened me up to a lot of other people. Didn't happen immediately, but that change, that whole different scenario kind of like broke me down a little bit for the good. And basically what I'm getting into, I started skiing. I never skied before. Long story short, I loved it. 2014, won a gold medal at slopestyle skiing, British Championships. Got sponsored. I rode for Armada, Patagonia. And then in competition, I snapped both my ACLs, crushed my meniscus, snapped my ankle. So that was it.
How'd that happen?
I did a double back key and overflipped the landing. Ugh. And I landed flat landing from a 60 footer.
Jesus.
And it was fucking brutal.
Well, I mean, I'm an exercise physiologist, and so I deal with helping athletes, normal people, whatever it might be, recovering from injuries. And I've basically dealt with musculoskeletal stuff my whole life. And so as soon as you said that, I'm like, holy shit, that's, both ACLs and, Achilles and that's a brutal thing to come back from, even just to walk in normal life again, let alone even think about back on a set of skis.
It was brutal. And they don't like to do the surgeries at the same time. So I had to do one, do the recovery, and then do the other. So I was out for so long. And I tried to come back. But then I was like, what can I do during my recovery period that's going to keep me kind of focused and I can still focus on the rehab? That's when I started yachting. And that was two years after that, basically. So I'd go there in the summer. I'd do a six-month stint on the boats. And then I'd come back to the Alps and do my rehabilitation. Mm. So I kept trying to come back. So I was still cooking. And while I was on the boat, kind of the role of the boat was kind of helping me focus on my posture and, working on the muscles around my knee. That was kind of my mindset. And when I was in the galley, I was just doing like little physiotherapy to keep it moving. I was also on a lot of painkillers because it hurt, man. It was uncomfortable. And when the sea was rough as well, when you're trying to cook and that movement, it sometimes got a bit too much.
Yeah.
Then I go back to the Alps, do the rehab, and I got onto the World Tour, free ride World Tour, and then I did it again, did my knee again. So.
And
that was that.
Yeah, I was going to say that's the end of that, yeah.
That was that. I didn't want to give up. And that's actually why I climbed Everest, because the skiing was out the window. It's kind of like, what can I do now? And the whole mental health thing was so big for me because of the journey, what I'd been on. And that's why I was like, right, let's just try and climb the highest mountain and raise awareness for mental health. And that was how that happened.
And so when did you go up Everest?
It was 2018.
So I was in Everest. I did base camp with my old man. It was always something that Dad and I had said we'd do together one of these days. But again, anyone who knows me, I'm terrified of flying. I hate flying, but I love traveling. So it's not something that's ever stopped. Like flying has never stopped me from doing things or going places. But it's always been in the back of my mind. And the idea of landing a small plane into a mountain, it was just like, there's no chance you're going to get me on that plane. And so Dad searched and searched for a tour guide company that could help try and walk the whole way in, but then catch the plane out. Because in my mind, I was like, I think leaving the mountain and flying off it is far easier in my mind to kind of wrap my head around than landing a plane into a mountain kind of thing. And so we found this trek that went from Jiri Jiri. And so it kind of added like 12 days to the hike, where we were hiking from basically the almost Kathmandu up to Lukla, and then the usual kind of Lukla trip around base camp from there. And I can still remember, long story I've shared before, in that we were literally only 2 hours from base camp, but Dad had a massive medical emergency where he almost died kind of thing. And it's still a pretty scary thing to think about, but we got off the mountain and all was good. And we kind of got back home. But I can remember basically at base camp going, I have zero want to now go up that mountain. Like I feel this was challenging enough. This was great. I feel like, this has been an amazing achievement, but I just want you to share with me, like, where does the mindset to like go and do something just so like, out of comfort zone, in death zone, when just getting to base camp is a difficult enough challenge for most people. Like, what was that drive? Or was it just kind of that typical mentality that you already had, that, you know, you can't just go 60% of the way, I got to go 100% in or it's nothing? Is it that kind of...
It's exactly that. There's no reason I should never have been there. You know, I've done Mont Blanc. That's the highest I've been, which is about 4,200 meters. And I kind of lied my way up there too. It's like, yeah, I've done Kilimanjaro. I've done this. I was like, I haven't done anything. which is not cool. But I really wanted to do it. And I just had this mindset. I was like, I'm going to do it. Started training. I've been in the Alps for so long. You know, I'm comfortable at 3,000 meters. I've done so much mountaineering. I feel like I can hold my own. And I really kind of wanted to give back to the mountains as well. Like, because I feel like growing around that sort of, from being where I was and then moving to the mountains and being around such like-minded people from all over the world, and then being so humbled by this whole experience, I kind of felt like I owe so much to it. I was like, right, I'm going to do it. And then I'm just going to kind of give people a hope, just give inspiration, and just going to go on this reckless trip. And I've been working on the boats. I've never had any money before. I just suddenly was getting chipped like 10 grand for a 2-week trip. I had spare cash. I was like, I'm just going to go and give it a go, you know? So what I did as well, so I got the sponsorships, and then everyone that donated to Calm, which is a campaign against living miserably. It's a mental health charity in the UK. Everyone who donated, I put their name on the flag, and that was going to be the flag I put on the summit.
Oh, cool.
So it was really, really, really sick. And yeah, so I raised nearly like £12,000, I think, for just Amazing. Like a solo. It was a lot of money just from just a solo guy with no kind of help, you know, just on Facebook or Instagram, just trying to raise some money. But we did the north side, so we didn't do the south side. So like you were saying, flying into Lukla and stuff, we didn't get to experience that, which I would love to do. So we flew into, we go Kathmandu, and then we drive through the Himalayas to the Chinese border. Mm-hmm. And then we were stuck at the Chinese border for like 24 hours, going through our laptops, stripping all our equipment apart, full search. It was pretty scary, actually. And then once we got there and we got to Tibet, it was such like third world. The food was shocking. I got food poisoning immediately. I'm pretty sure it was food poisoning. I had to come down 1,000 meters to recover, and then I went back up before I got to base camp. So I actually thought I was done, and that was only like 4,000.
Yeah.
And eventually getting to base camp as well. Like you say, it's just such a game changer. You're putting your tents up and then surrounding your tents with the huge rocks, like lifting the boulders. Just exhausted. I was like, whoa, what have I got myself into here? Fucking hell. Just 5,200 meters, which like we said, is high. Like it's high anyway, and it has such a huge effect on your body. And we hadn't really started getting going yet. But it was such an amazing experience. And, you know, I didn't shower for 6 weeks, fully broke me, hallucinating in the tent, not being able to sleep, not being able to keep water down, not being able to eat for weeks and weeks, like diarrhea the whole time, you know, like there's nothing pretty about it, you know, rarely changed out of my thermals, rarely changed my socks, you know, kept my boots on most of the time in the sleeping bag. Pretty sure this is rough, but there's like, you know, like debris on the backs of my legs. It was just like, because you can't fully squat down, because if you squat, you get frostbite at certain altitudes.
Yeah.
So it was such an experience, honestly. I mean, being surrounded by these people that I'd never met before, being super vulnerable with them, I was worried that they were going to be like these rich guys who just, there was a few of them. Few arrogant rich people who didn't really care about you or anyone else. But it was also, it wasn't that, you know, there's this huge brotherhood that we created, and we kind of looked out for each other, and it was really, really cool.
Was there any kind of really like sliding doors type moments going up the mountain at all, and kind of before you're reaching that, you know, if this happens, then this trip is over. I'm not going to reach the top. But it didn't, and you kind of were able to manage your way through it. I mean, it's it's always painted as such a pretty picture. Everyone gets the picture at the top and they get that moment standing on top of the world and it looks so amazing. And yet nothing usually is documented behind it, showing that you're basically shitting yourself up there for a couple of weeks and the kind of grind of going up and back and up and back. And that, like, were there moments where it's like, we might not be able to complete this trip? And like, kind of just, can you kind of tell us a little bit between base camp and actual summiting?
So like it's brutal and there's nothing, like I said, nothing pretty about it. It's exhausting. And you probably do about 19 kilometers a day throughout like 12 hours of walking. And like you say, you go up, you sleep, you come back down to acclimatize. And we're not NIMS, you know, we're not NIMS from 14 peaks. You can't just smash it out. You've got to go up, rest. But the hardest thing about it, your body's just deteriorating. So you can't, like, you can't do anything. Like you say, you rest, all you're doing is just trying to save that little bit of energy you have left in the jar. But when you get up to advanced base camp, you know, that's such a huge trek. Like intermediate base camp, we call it Yak Camp on the north side. They're just all the yaks and all like the pirates that are kind of looking after the yaks, the bells, and they've got their little fires going. It's such an amazing scenery. It's just yak shit everywhere. Like there's nothing. Like the surroundings pretty cool, but really you're just in, like, it's like something off Star Wars. Mm. Like you're just in the middle of nowhere. And then when you go onto advanced base camp, again, that's getting a bit more rough. It's getting way colder. And then to get up to the North Col, man, it's sketchy. And when we got to the top of the North Col, which is like 7,500 meters, the clouds started to come in like fast. It was blue sky and it was not cold at all. It was really, really hot climbing up this North Col. Mm. I got so sunburned on the side of my face. I was wearing a t-shirt, which I wish I didn't do. I got super sunburned and I was really, really uncomfortable. And instantly it changed. Blizzard, cold as fuck, sunstroke, sunburn. What do I do now? So we set up camp and we just stayed up there. And I was shivering. I was in such a bad place. And I had back surgery 12 months prior. I had decompression surgery on my back.
Mm.
And they put a spring in my spine to lift it, basically what it was. Because of the altitude, it tried to leave, my back. So I got a cyst on my spine, fully infected, the smell was disgusting. I can still kind of smell it now, just talking about it. And that's when I had a question. I was like, well, what am I going to do now? If I come back, I don't want to put anyone at risk. So at that point, I stayed there for 2 days, and then I actually went back down to base camp from North Col. I stopped at advanced base camp and went back down to just really think about, like, what am I going to do here? You know, I have these issues. And there was no doctor on the site. It's not like the south side. The north side, like, you're on your own.
Sure.
It's like zombie land. There's no one there. There's no helicopter rescue. There's no rescue. As soon as you get to 6,000 meters, you're by yourself. You're stuck. So yeah, that was sketchy. I actually thought I was going to die. And I, you know, sometimes I was like, is this a suicide mission? I always wondered if it was. What is this, a suicide mission? And that was when I kind of realized that I did value my life, don't want to die. I really cared about myself in that point. I had loved myself and I was proud of myself. And that was a real turning point in my life for me, to be fully broken and rebuild myself and then believe in myself and be proud of myself, have love for myself. And that's where I feel like a huge aspect of showing vulnerability and weakness to come back, you know, to recover is a huge strength. Because if I was arrogant and I pushed further through that scenario, potentially could have lost my life and would never have got that second chance, you know?
Is that kind of a moment then, you know, let's just say you didn't die in the mountains, but you did keep going. Do you think your life would be completely different to where it is now, having not gone through a breakdown moment to kind of bring you back to your bare skin, bare moments, kind of bare everything to kind of, I guess, bare your soul to yourself and kind of have that realization that, no, I've gone through a lot and here I am and no, I do value life and everything. Like if you hadn't gone through that and you just kind of kept on pushing, got through it, mate, you know, got to the summit, got your photo, and then kind of came back off, and you know, you kind of, where do you think life may have kind of sliding door split at that moment? Do you think it would have been vastly different to where you are now?
I think it would have been vastly different. Yeah, I reckon if you just keep pushing and pushing, eventually you're just going to explode, right? I mean, and that was kind of on the below deck when that happened. If I didn't have that moment, I would have lost my mind, you know, and I, especially in that scenario, it's the same thing. If I pushed then for that summit under all that stress and strain, with that mental, me thinking in my head, there's so many people counting on me, I've got to do this. It's like, well, actually, no, what you got to do is realize the bigger picture, like why you're here, realize that you can fail, and then you'll get another chance. And the thing is, like what we're saying, it's not a failure. And that's, which was huge. I reckon it would be a completely different scenario. I reckon if I maybe pushed for it in that situation then, and stepped living in this dream world of everything's always going to be fine if you just keep pushing and pushing and pushing yourself, then who knows what would have happened at the other end, you know? I don't think it would have been the same scenario.
And where does it kind of, you know, you said that was 2018?
Yeah, so where, 2018, yeah.
You come back off Everest. Do you go straight back into chefing and cooking, or kind of what did life look like, you know, 6 months, 18 months after that?
I got back down, and then a girl I was seeing at the time, I went straight to San Sebastian. Mm-hmm. I was in Hossegor at the time. I opened up two restaurants in a place called Senos after that, a little brunch cafe, and then did like a tapas, and then like kind of fusion restaurant right on the water at Estanio, where the Quick Pro is. Sick location, banging.
San Sebastian is one of my favorite towns in the world. I love that place.
Oh my God, it's incredible. The best food in the world. I don't care what anyone says. Like, nothing compares. It's insane. It's the food hub of the world. Honestly, I stayed in this place. It's called the Accolair on the top of the hill. Three Michelin star restaurant. I was like, right, I'm going to go for it. Stayed here. There was like an infinity pool in my room. And obviously, I've just been living in my own shit for fucking weeks and weeks. And I was like, right, just going to go for it here. Man, it was just over the hills in the Basque Country. Like, this building was insane. I had like a 19-course meal. It was absolutely incredible. That's what I did when I got down. Opened up the two restaurants. And to be honest, it was so difficult. You know, I was working every single day. I wanted to surf. I couldn't. Me and my business partner, Gav. They were super busy and really, really successful, which is awesome. But it was really getting to me. Started drinking a lot, wasn't training anymore. Started doing quite a few drugs just to kind of get me through. I was working like 18 hours a day. I was just grafting two places, you know, owning a restaurant and being a head chef in it. It was just another level of stress. So that's what happened, and COVID hit, and that really sent me over.
Right.
So from this peak of really finding myself and being this weapon, so to speak, this new mentally stable, strong god, so to speak, in my mind, you know, I'd overcome, I'm feeling really good about myself, and it all went out the window. And 3 years of doing that, COVID hit, and then that's when I had a choice to make. I was like, right, do we keep this open or do I take on another opportunity to keep moving forward, you know? And that's what I did. I kind of just got up and left pretty much. Before the season ended, that's when Below Deck happened. I was like, I went on, joined, shit, my battery's going to die. I joined Below Deck. I went on charter, met Natasha before we both went on Below Deck, did that month charter. So straight from that period, COVID, like the restaurants, when they shut down, I went and did a month charter with Russians, and then I went straight into Below Deck. That's what I did after Everest.
So the charter, as you're saying, with the Russians there, you walk away from the businesses because I presume COVID shutting everything down and there's nothing kind of going on. Do you just have contacts in the industry and just like kind of find a boat by chance, by contacts, or you just literally walk down to a marina somewhere and kind of started putting your hand up and saying, I'm a chef, I can work it? Like, how did that kind of first charter come up before then? I'll ask the question kind of how Below Deck kind of came about after that.
It was through a friend of a friend, an Aussie captain actually from Byron. He offered me the job, the chef. He walked off like just before the charter came on. And just it was a last minute thing. He's like, you have to leave tomorrow. Can you do it? He's like, can you come to Croatia? I'm like, sure, no worries, I'll do it. And that's basically it just happened like that. Change.
How difficult was it to get to Croatia with like COVID going on and I presume countries starting to shut down? Like how difficult was it to kind of get across there?
The kind of yachting world at the time is if you had a bit of paper, it would allow you to cross borders. Right. So that was the only thing that was kind of running. You couldn't do the Caribbean crossing or the Atlantic crossing. But you could go kind of between Europe. But it was weird. It was super weird. Like there was people with huge guns in the airport and then it was just me kind of traveling. You know, there's only a few people flying at a time. And it was a really wild, wild time. Like it really, really was. It was weird. Hey, I'm going to have to plug my laptop in.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, mate. That's all right. I'm going to mess the whole podcast up.
All good. I'll just edit this bit out. So yeah, plug it in. All good.
I'm actually going to have to move my... I just moved into this new place and it's all over the joint. Yeah, I'm going to have to stay. Do it there.
That's all good.
Right, sorry.
All good. So you landed in Croatia?
Yeah, and then join a charter.
Where do you take off out of Croatia?
So we went to where they filmed the Game of Thrones. What's it called?
Zagreb, Split, Hvar, Dubrovnik.
So I flew into Dubrovnik. That's it. So we started in Dubrovnik, and then we did a whole cruise from there. I mean, I'm just in a galley all the time, so I didn't get to see anything. we had a bunch of real demanding guests on, actually. And it was a month-long charter. But the galley was sick. Sous chef was a legend. The crew were cool. Met Natasha. She was great at the time. and that was kind of... And then we decided to shut the restaurants down. I felt it had a huge effect on me because I did just abandon my business partner pretty much. He kind of gave me like... He said, look, you got to go and do it. Just go and do it. I'll finish the season off. We had a great team, you know, but I did leave them in the shit. So I kind of have to live with that now too. That was kind of... I never really do a decision for myself. I always worry about other people around me. And this was a time where I just had to do it. Sometimes I feel like it's better to do that. It's kind of that, you know, putting your hands up, being like, okay, I've got to go for my own stability here, my own mental health. Like everything I just put into this for the last 3 years, it's kind of, we're about to lose it. It was like a €1 million a season business and we were in debt. It just didn't make any sense.
Yeah, right.
And obviously, when the COVID hit, we could only have half the amount of guests on the terrace. We had 20 staff. So it didn't make any sense. We had 20 staff. And in France, the way the system's set up, it's designed for the business owners to fail, pretty much. So even though the guys weren't allowed to work, we still had to pay them. But when we got nothing from the government, and we couldn't fill the seats in the restaurant. It was such a, and you could only serve booze in like plastic cups, like takeaway, and
right, yeah.
It was a whole situation.
Yep.
So that's what happened, and I joined the boat, got some cash, managed to kind of get us out of the debt situation with the French government. And then Below Deck 2 days after we dropped off charter.
So, I mean, I'm just curious kind of the how that comes about, because I've asked Nat, and, you know, I kind of, again, I'm a below deck super fan from way back. I've watched every season from both, you know, the below deck med and obviously the other side of it as well. And now some of the spin-offs they've had of it. But I've been a real big fan of the show, and I'm always curious kind of how that kind of comes about, and kind of almost asking the question, like, why would you want to put yourself into it? Because it just looks like absolute chaos. And so I've known quite a few people who've worked in the industry, in the yachting industry myself, know a couple of bosuns and a couple of stew staff and things like that. But it sounds like a great life for most of it, in that, yeah, it's a lot of hard work, but, you know, traveling the world, you meet these amazing people, and it seems great. But then when I then flip that and you put a TV crew in there and a kind of curation of the reality show, and it kind of seems to take a bit of that gloss off it. And so I want to kind of ask the first question is, like, you've just finished charter. Do you get a tap on the shoulder from someone that just is in the know, and, hey, we've got this opening on this TV show? Or, like, how does that kind of come about? And then two, I'll ask the question after you've said all that, like, was it everything you thought it was going to be, worse than you thought it was be, better than, like, so first of all, kind of, how did you get onto the show?
So basically how it started was, I started applying for it while I was in the restaurant back in France. And then I was kind of getting through the interview process. And then at the last minute, towards the stage on the charter, that's when I got the call saying, okay, when can you start? And they tried to get me to leave earlier. And I was just like, there's no way I'm leaving these guys in the shit. I'm not doing that, you know? So I literally dropped off charter, went back just to France quickly, and then flew straight to Malta. Mm. The yachting industry, I'd recommend anyone getting into it. It's incredible. You get to travel the world, you earn good money. It's really, really hard work, but it's such a good way to travel, you know, and get yourself out there. So I really, really recommend that to anyone. But being on below deck is yachting on steroids, because it's kind of designed to stitch you up. Like, to be honest, we join the boat, and then 24 hours later, you pick up guests. I haven't ordered any food yet. I haven't cleaned the galley. I've got no kitchen equipment. Like, if I didn't bring my own equipment with me, it would have been a nightmare. Like, I brought my own sous vide, thermo mix. I brought all my baking stuff. I didn't have that. And that galley was shocking. It was so small. I had no storage space. It was an absolute nightmare.
And what would that normally look like? Sorry to interrupt. Like, if you kind of normally turned up to a charter, like that one that you had just been on, how many days would it be to kind of you to get prep before you actually have to start working with guests and kind of being on charter?
So if I was, say, I was a temp chef and I joined a team that they were ready to go, that would be different. Depends on how early I can get there, you know. If the chef kind of walks out the day before, it happens quite a lot. The chef walks out the day before charter gets to turn up, then you could be straight into it. But then you'd have someone there who's already got it set up. The galley would be clean, you know. It would have been provisioned. Food would have been on board. But in an ideal world, you need like a week to get ready. Like, you like leave the marina you're in. You leave the marina you're in. You get at anchor where you pick the guests up. Then you detail the boat. And you start prepping. It's like a week in advance. Mm. And we were doing it in 24 hours. Everything. It's honestly, and it's, and you wonder why. And it's not staged. This is how it is, with a camera following you around 24/7 with people you've never seen before, apart from obviously Natasha I've worked with before. And it's just like a whole another world. And you kind of, the funny thing about it is, if you're not used to the cameras, like, I did MasterChef for professionals back in the day, and like, I was nervous on the camera, but this situation, it was kind of, you didn't really have time to think about it. Mm. Even though it was there all the time, you just, because it's so in the moment, and you do sometimes forget that it's there, which was really, really interesting. Apart from a lot of the time underneath the sink, I'd have my coffee, I'd put my head underneath the sink, just so I knew there was no one there, I could just breathe a little bit, because obviously you get filmed sleeping, and they're everywhere. And absolutely everywhere all the time.
with that, is there, I mean, you say, you know, there's no staging of it and things like that, but do you kind of, as you said, you kind of are so in it and so busy and kind of going that you can kind of sometimes forget that they're even there. Do you kind of have conversations or you're doing something that they then come in and go, hey, that looked really good. Can we actually refilm you doing that kind of, like, do those kind of, I guess, situations come about?
That does happen. There was a few things where, because especially in the galley, like you, what you guys don't see is most of the time I was doing 9 courses. Like all they do is show 1 or 2 dishes. That's the annoying thing about it. Like there wasn't one time where I just did a normal 3-course meal. I was doing like 11, 12, 7 courses all the time. So yeah, I'd be prepping stuff up, making sorbet with like nitrogen. They'd be like, oh, can you just do that again? I'm just like, I'm a yes guy. I'm like, yeah, of course. I want to look good on camera, right? Of course I'll do that again. Why didn't you get it the first time? But yeah, no, you're right. It's a good question, actually, because that does happen. So there was a few things, I guess, that kind of are staged like that, but not really. Yeah. And then there's a few times that it happens if, you know, if I was like texting, they'd ask me to like, can you just sit here and do this for a bit? But that's honestly the only thing. Everything else happens. It's not staged. The production team are really cool, really nice people. I mean, I think they're awesome. Super supportive. It was one of the hardest things I've done, probably harder than Everest, to be honest. It was really, really difficult after the show. I nearly quit twice. Like, what am I doing here? I don't need to be here. You know, I'm confident in my trade. I don't need to do this. Captain Sammy taught me out of it because she's a legend. And I'm so glad that I didn't leave. If I did, it would have been the biggest regrets of my life, you know. Sucking that up and getting through that was one of the best achievements of my life, to be honest. Honestly, I met incredible people, and now I look back at it, that 6 weeks felt like 2 years, and it was an amazing experience to deal with all that mentally and come out the other end of it. It was an incredible journey, to be fair.
And if I can kind of be a bit candid and kind of ask you, and feel free to tell me to fuck off by asking the question, but kind of what was the moment that kind of really brought about that, in quote, breakdown that you had? Was it just like the COVID situation or walking away from that restaurant, other kind of past things coming to mind, the Tash situation that you're going through, the show? Like, was it everything combined, or was there one thing that was like, you know what, it was when that happened that it kind of really, I'd had enough, and kind of that was me done at that moment?
It was definitely a build up. You know, I kind of am a, to get to a point, I can take quite a lot. I feel like I'm quite strong. And I was holding on all of that, what you just said. I was keeping all of that on board. But it was when I got drunk and I text Natasha that night. And that was the tipping point for me, because I was so pissed off with myself that I had succumbed to that, and I was so annoyed with myself. I couldn't catch. I couldn't breathe. I was like, I was going to be sick. It was such a horrible feeling. Almost the point of failure. I didn't care that people caught me on camera just being a normal human being who had a heart. Like, whatever. It's the fact that I almost dishonored myself, you know. Everything I've been through to get to where I was today, I kind of felt like I failed myself. And that's when I just fucking exploded. It was a full week. Honestly, I couldn't breathe. I couldn't catch my breath. That's why I was kind of wrapped myself around the toilet. And then one of the girls, Tiana, she like looks after the talent. She could obviously hear me, and people realized there was something not quite right, you know. And then they were there to really supportive, and Sandy was like straight on the scene, helped me through it step by step. If I didn't have that breakdown, tell you what, God help everyone. Tell you that right now.
And I mean, to that, and I said it from the very beginning of that, and from this episode. And again, I truly, you know, thank you for being open and honest just now here with me. But on that show, it's genuinely, I think, one of the first times I've seen a reality show have a reality moment. Like I tend to watch those shows just because it's a bit of an escape for me. I live quite a, I've got a couple of kids and I run my own business and things. I have quite a serious life, and it's hilarious when I tell my clients, because I'm almost kind of Jekyll and Hyde. Like if you know me throughout my normal kind of working life and being a father, you wouldn't think I'd ever watch these kind of shows, but I actually enjoy them because they're a bit of an escape for me. And seeing your kind of moment in that, for me at least, it was kind of like it was just this real kind of release of I felt that release you were having. And I'm not going to say I'm too high strung myself. I live a pretty relaxed life here in Perth. I get to surf. I've got my family and I have a very, you know, relaxing type life. But I felt as though in a moment that it's okay to be vulnerable. And you were showing that and you had that moment. And I mean, I'm sharing that with you, that that's the way I felt and saw it. And yeah, you might have had, you know, done some things that you regret. There might have been some things that, you know, you're like, I'm not really proud of that moment I had. But what was the kind of reaction that was given? I presume you only got to see how the reaction was once it kind of aired. What was the kind of reaction that you kind of got from social media or kind of feedback from fans of the show kind of talking about that moment and things like that? Was it mostly negative, mostly positive? What did you feel was kind of coming back your way?
It's the best question actually, because this was incredible. It was about 98% positive. There was some, the 2% were brutal. The 2% of messages I got were brutal. After the show, I went to Salita on the Mexican Caribbean, long left-hander, just went there, surf for a month, couldn't be around anyone. Just hid away, because again, I was broken. I had to fucking recover and just be in the sun and surf. But the 2% was super negative. People were messaging me saying, call yourself a man. You don't deserve to have balls. Crying yourself to sleep. You let this woman control you. Like, who are you? Are you living in this world? Do you hear what you're saying? And it was so hard for me not to say anything, because I would love to say something. I was like, oh. But sometimes I just winked, put a winky face back, or just a laughing emoji or something or whatever. But everyone else was so gracious and showed me such gratitude for and thanking me and, you know, saying it was so amazing that you did that. I feel it's helped me through a lot of things. I've been able to be more open, and a lot of men and a lot of the wives of their husbands were like, this is the only show they can watch. They felt, you know, they felt really humbled by watching you on TV. It had a huge effect on my husband's life, and, which was really, really cool for me. And that actually, that helped me through the whole process. So it was a really, really positive response, which is good.
And it's to that point. I mean, you know, so many people feel scared to kind of open up, and I'll speak just kind of one-sided, especially for men. You know, this whole just be a, like you kind of said, you know, that 2% that were kind of like, you're not a man, like how dare you, you know, that kind of reaction that so many men in particular feel that they have to just be this rock all the time, and you can't show emotion, you can't kind of let things out for fear that the reaction is going to be what that 2% was. But in reality, I think, you know, you sharing that with us, and I think anyone who followed the show kind of would have seen that there was an overwhelming kind of positive response, that hopefully it does allow men to kind of really go, fuck, I can be a bit more open with, be it my best mates or other people.
Definitely. And the only people that were being negative, so it would have been, and the comments I got from women too, some women were just like, some of them are brutal. I'm just like, who are you? Like, you're just sitting on your laptop eating God knows what. I can just see this troll now.
Yeah.
They're the people that who have done probably nothing in their life, and they have no stories to tell. And how dare they anyway judge anyone? This is like, how dare you? This is how I felt, and this is how I'm gonna react. And I can say to anyone now, always speak the way you feel. Like, show vulnerability. It's a game changer. And and so many people will respect it, and it's important for people to do it. And like you said, that positive effect, man, 98%, I'm telling you, is such an incredible reaction.
So you stay on the show. Sandy, you know, convinces you as well as the producers to kind of stay on. You see out the season, you see out the show. The show ends, you know, as you said, you go your own way. You find a great left-hand wave to kind of chill out and kind of, you know, enjoy. Yeah. What's kind of been, I guess, life post that? And I'd love to get, obviously, start talking about the Everest dinner that you kind of started planning, but kind of immediately after the show and beyond, kind of what's like, have you gone straight back into chefing? Are you back on yachts? Like, what's been life post the show? How has it changed life?
So I went and did that, and then I got a job on a boat, 50-meter charter, 2 months on, 2 months off. Joined it in Miami, went skydiving, my parachute didn't open, broke my back. That was that's what, yeah, 2 months after the show. I do a lot of jumping in Sebastian, and up in North Florida. Hadn't jumped in a while. I've got this thick black canopy, jumped out of plane, had a malfunction, tried to correct it, super blasé about it. 700 feet, I was like, shit, I better cut away now. Pulled my reserve chute. I was under a sea of trees. I couldn't get out of the way. I hit a tree, basically.
Shit.
Full spinal fusion. 250 grand it cost. Mount Sinai in Miami. Thank God, I don't know how, the boat insurance covered it. I have no idea how. So lucky. There's no way I would have been able to pay that.
Jesus Christ.
Honestly, I woke up in hospital.
Do you remember hitting the ground? Like, were you conscious between it all? And
had a helmet on. I was conscious, yeah. Look, I didn't, like, hit the tree really hard. We all know I've had, like, well, I said I've had back pain. It wasn't like I splattered on the floor. I was still under canopy. Smashed my helmet to pieces on the tree. Lost my GoPro. And then I was unconscious, woke up in hospital. I actually got checked out of hospital there, and they missed it, the hospital I was in. I couldn't move. I couldn't lift my left leg, basically. I just couldn't move my left leg. So I was like, this isn't right. Went back into hospital in Miami. They're like, yeah, you broke two vertebrae. We need to operate. I was like, sweet. Okay. I was just like, let's just do it. We had this conference call, and the surgeons they seemed so excited about it. I don't know why. So they did this full spinal fusion, had the operation. It went through my abdomen and my spine. So I've got this gnarly scar on my front, which is super uncomfortable, actually. I honestly, 3 months, I was skiing 3 months after the operation. Crazy.
There you go.
Absolutely crazy.
What year was that?
And that was 2021.
21, okay.
2021. Yep. That Christmas, I did it December 5th. And then I had the operation. My good friend Luke, Aussie guy, took me in, him and his wife looked after me through my recovery, making me turmeric tea every morning. I was in a really, really bad way after that. You know, I was so uncomfortable. I could barely move. It was pretty gnarly. But then I got really focused, flew to the French Alps, did my rehab in the French Alps. I was back on my feet, I think, probably like 3 months later. Amazing, amazing job they did in the hospital.
And so you kind of, what, we're talking early, mid-22, then you're kind of back on your feet, you're in the French Alps. Have you been back on a yacht since? Are you kind of working or looking at opening a restaurant, or you know, what's the trip to Everest? And I'd love to hear about that dinner that you were going to plan up Everest.
So the boat I was actually on at the time, they kept me on, and I went back onto that boat.
Right.
I went joined the boat again 3 months later. And then I had one of these moments. I was in Monaco, south of France, Monaco boat show. I had a moment. I was like, I can't do this anymore. Just packed my bags and walked off. I had those situations. It's not a good thing to do. I don't recommend anyone doing it. But for me, if I feel like I'm not comfortable or stable, I just change my scene. I'm like, I've got to go. I know that I won't be able to recover from it. I have to move and do something else. I just have a feeling. So that's what I do. Pack my bags. I was at the bus stop in Monaco. I was like, where am I going to go now? And I went to Ukraine. And I cooked during the war for tens of thousands of people. That's what I did after that. Did two months there, which was one of the best experiences of my life. Super humbling. I met some incredible people. We were set up on the Polish border, just a stone throw away from Lviv in Ukraine, and we were cooking for 10,000 people a day.
Were there people just coming across the border from Ukraine?
Coming across the border from Ukraine, and then we would also do set up soup kitchens all around by the train station, and all this food we put into trucks and then delivered different checkpoints. Man, as we would do, like, each wok would be like 15,000 portions. Sorry, 1,500 portions, sorry. We would have like 10,000 portions of banana bread everywhere. Like, the local bakeries gave us stale bread, and then we would just soak it overnight in custard, do these sick bread and butter puddings with this stale bread. Just, it was really, really such an amazing operation that Jose Andreas is for World Central Kitchen. Really humbling experience. And then before I left, I was like, I want to see what's been going on. So I actually went into Ukraine. And obviously, as soon as I got there, there's a bomb warning. So I'm in a bunker in this hotel. 3 hours later, I get let out, and all the street, it's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. So no one's on the street. The siren goes off. The bombs get shot. The cruise missiles get shot down. And then the alarms stop. Everyone goes on the street. And I was by the opera house, and there's these water fountains. And I just saw these kids flooding out, just playing around in the water fountains, laughing, having the best time of their life, just knowing that they have another day to live. It was the most humbling thing I've ever seen in my whole entire life. It was honestly such. And I saw enough there, and I left straight away. I was like, went back over the border, and then I joined another boat after that.
And so where does the idea come about to, create a dinner in Everest? I mean, I'd love to know where your idea of, like, where it was going to be. And as I said, I know it hasn't gone through, and share with me kind of how that came about or why. But, like, where's the original idea to kind of host a dinner up in Everest?
When I was on the north side, the BBC did a 7,000-meter dinner, and the guy, Sat Bain, got altitude sickness, so he couldn't do the meal. And they basically paid Sherpas to do the meal for him, which is cheating, by the way. So I saw that. So I was like, right, I want to do this. I'm going to do it at 8,000 meters. And I was like, this is what I'm going to do. This is my mission. Spoke to Nims from 14 Peaks, his agents, set up this whole experience. They were on board. We've been planning it for months and months and months. It was getting really, really pricey, obviously, to have Nims at the table as well. 8,000 meters, and the idea in the end was for me to cook for the Sherpas and give back to the gods who look after everyone on the hill. That was kind of the inspiration for it. Got the go-ahead from the Guinness World Records. That got signed off, so we're moving forward. I was like, well, what do I do now to get the funding for this? It was getting really, really pricey. So I reached out to some producers. We built a deck, a script, and we were going to film it. A lot of people were really interested. And then the funding pulled last minute, literally last minute, which I'm gutted about. I don't want to go too name names or too many details,
but of course,
it will happen, and it is going to happen, 100%. I'm not going to give up. And Nims and his team are really excited to do it. But pretty much the pulling point was the network wanted one of their celebrity chefs on the show with me, and they weren't ready. Pretty much was why they pulled the funding. So it would have been me, this person, Nims and his team, and we would have been in Kathmandu getting all the local produce and building this menu and getting this equipment and setting up this epic tent at 8,000 meters. So you're like, on the summit, you're like 8,000 meters, you can't breathe in a death zone. And it's like a blizzard, and you walk into this tent, and it's like you've just gone through a portal into this paradise of this little restaurant in the middle of nowhere where you have to have black suit ties on. It's this three course meal, and that was the whole. It was gonna be so sick. It was such an incredible journey this would have been. But it's, and it will happen. And I kind of, that was the whole idea. So I've been training for the last year and it fell through. I was so gutted. But I managed to get my O1 visa after that. And now I've just been cooking for high profile people in Florida. Just got a place in West Palm Beach. So I kind of based myself here. It's really good for work. The show's been really, really good for me. It's got a good following, a good network. And it's been great. And I'm currently writing a book at the moment. It's like a recipe book with a story to tell. So it's kind of some of the stuff we spoke about earlier, about being vulnerable, about the pros of doing extreme sports, keeping fit, keeping like your mental stability stable through being active and being vulnerable, into the places I've been around the world with recipes, basically.
Amazing.
A storybook of a journey to tell. That's kind of
absolutely
what I'm working on.
Well, I'm super keen to kind of, you know, when you do get that that meal done, and should the book get released and all those kind of things, you know, I want to be super selfish and ask you back on the show and have more of your time, mate, because I'd love to hear more about definitely. It when it actually goes through, because yeah, that sounds epic.
I'd have to get myself to Perth. I'd love to. I've been to Perth once, and I went to this weird desert, and I flew in from Bali. It's such a funny story, actually. I met this girl on Tinder, this Russian model, and I flew in and drove 8 hours to a desert, to the Pink Lake, is it?
Yeah.
You heard of the Pink
Lake? Yeah, I went the Pink there. Lake, yeah, right.
It's the only place I've ever been with this model. She was a nightmare. I drove with her, we went to this place, and then we drove back. Never met her before. It was an absolute nightmare. And then I just flew back to Bali afterwards. It's the only time I've been to Australia.
Well, if you can get a flight home with Nat, and we can all meet up in Perth at some time, mate, it'd be great. And I'll certainly show you around Perth a little bit more and show you the sights and sounds.
I'd honestly love that. That'd be absolutely epic.
That'd be great, mate. Epic. Well, Matt, again, I can't thank you enough for, you know, the honesty in the show, but the honesty that you've given us here today. And I said, you know, just to give permission that you have to, you know, not only myself, but to those who watch the show, and I guess people who have just been in your journey as well. And so, you know, if I can say it myself, but I'm sure you've heard it many times before, thank you for, you know, what you do and what you've done and what you continue to do. Because, I love the show anyway, and I always will, but I really enjoyed your time on it. And whether you can say it or whether you're not too sure or whatnot, I really hope I see you back on there, mate, because you've been one of my my favorite kind of characters, for lack of a better word, on that. And so I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thanks, man. That's good. I haven't got any hair on my head, but it kind of made it single.
You and me both there, mate. You and me both.
I would go back on, and I feel like I want chefs to fail a bit more in the kitchen. I don't know. I can't really say. You never know. I might be back on there one day.
Well, I did see a post the other day that I think you'd kind of caught up with a few of the other kind of people from, like, not only your season but others, and like the headline was, you know, will there be a superstars kind of below deck or super fans kind of thing? So that would be very cool.
That'd be so good. They were so good hanging out with those guys. They're such awesome people, you know, and they're so easy to get on with. And obviously you get a couple of bad eggs, but they're such epic people. And I would love to do that. I'd love to do an All-Stars Below Deck. That'd be awesome. And I really want to go back on just to kind of for redemption almost. Mm. I want to show people like I can add more. I can do what the food, like I can do better, you know, and I want to show the person that I am without all of this stuff kind of hanging over me, which I had with Natasha. So I would like to go back on there as, you know, with a kind of a clean slate.
Awesome. Well, fingers crossed that might happen sometime. But again, yeah, I really appreciate everything you've done for the show, but also for giving me your time today, man. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thanks a lot, man.
Anytime. Well, I always like to do right at the end of the podcast, I always have last week's guest ask this week's guest a random question. So if you don't mind indulging me in the question that was given to by last week's guest for you. The question was, what's something you strongly believed in the past that you have changed your mind on significantly? And how did that come about?
Oh, I think I was, let's just say, I used to fight a lot, right? I used to fight an awful lot, something I'm not proud of. But obviously I got away from that and changed my whole kind of life around. I never really thought that you could talk your way out of a situation or walk away and be a bigger man from a situation. And being able to show emotion and basically just being able to kind of, if you feel at the moment that you can't suppress it or get past it, just walk away. So what I'm trying to say is that bigger men basically can just walk away from situations. And that's something that I never really used to believe in. I thought you had to kind of throw a punch first. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'm not very good at explaining things.
No, I think you've done that. I mean, as you said, kind of fighting your way through things, thinking you have to just be, you know, that alpha kind of, just I'll punch my way through it and get it through it. But realizing that no, words can have power and can have meaning, and that you can step away from it. I think that's a really beautiful message.
Absolutely. There you go. That's exactly what I was trying to say.
I'll follow it up then. I need to ask you, what's your question that you have for next week's guest?
If there was, this is a tough one.
I always put people on the spot.
If there's anywhere in the world you could book, where would it be and who would it be with?
Where would it be and who would it be with?
Who would it be with?
I can answer. I mean, if you don't mind me sharing my kind of favorite food moment just with you for a second, in that I can answer that question instantaneously. And I've been lucky enough to be, I used to be into really fine dining type experiences. I love the experience. And I've been lucky enough to have some clients of mine that introduced me to some fine dining type stuff and had some amazing nights out. And I'm not going to ever regret those. And I've loved them for what they were, and even how much money you had to spend to kind of do those types of experiences. But I can still say without even hesitating, the best food moment I've had in my life, and I would recreate it in a second to kind of answer that question, is that my wife and I, we had a lovely honeymoon going through France, Spain, and Italy, and we got to spend some time down in Granada in the bottom of Spain, overlooking the Alhambra. And we were staying, we were only there for a couple of nights, and we were staying at a pretty dodgy kind of, not dodgy, but kind of a pretty cheap and nasty kind of like hostel kind of place there, because we were trying to put all of our money into some of these things that we're doing in France. And so Spain and Italy kind of were secondary thoughts. We did a lot more in France kind of thing. And so, but this thing had this rooftop kind of terrace that had a rusty old lock to get up there. And we went and asked the front desk, like, how do we get on the terrace? And they're like, oh, you kind of can't, we kind of lock it, we don't want people up there. So we kind of found our way up there. But during the day, we had kind of gone to the local markets and got ourselves some, you know, cured meats and a cheap bottle of red wine. And I've got the photo. I said, it was a pretty staged photo, but I set the camera up behind us. Alhambra is in the background, and we just sat there for hours as we watched the sun setting, overlooking the Alhambra, awesome, eating cured meats and having a cheap bottle of red wine. And that experience would have been 10 euros worth of stuff. And yet it is the greatest experience I've ever had around food, and doing it with obviously my new wife at the time. We've now been together almost 10 years, but that was a pretty special moment. I'd love to recreate that sometime.
Awesome, mate. You can never beat a little charcuterie cheese board and a nice bottle of wine as well.
Absolutely.
All the acidity, the chutneys with a sunset. That's epic. That's a great story. Love that. Good for you, man.
Dave, thank you so much. I hope that we can cross paths again when you do kind of break that world record and have that dinner up at 8,000. And as I said, mate, if you're ever in Perth, please let me know. I'll certainly show you some great surf breaks, and we'll have some fun.
I'd love that. Definitely. I'll see you next week.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, again, mate, can't thank you enough. Is there, just to kind of put it in the show notes anyway, but kind of say it verbally, is anywhere people can reach you on or kind of follow you? What's kind of best way to kind of look at what you're doing or kind of keep up to date with what you're doing at the moment?
So I keep kind of a lot of information on my Instagram, which is at Chef Dave White. But I'm gonna be doing like a lot of pop-ups like in the next few days and over the next couple of years. And then the idea is I'm trying to get my own show. I just got a new agent and trying to get a show called like Extreme Chef. Gonna be the Extreme Anthony Bourdain.
Oh, here
so
we go.
Yeah, so keep your eyes out on the Food Network for a show. Fingers crossed. I mean, I don't know if that's gonna happen. I'm just dreaming here.
Yeah,
just
mate, dreaming. Love it. So, dream big. I love it.
That's it. So fingers crossed.
Matt, I'll keep them all crossed for you, and I'm sure the audience listening in will. So, yeah, it's been a great hour of your time, Matt, and I really appreciate it, and thanks for the chat.
Legend. All the best, mate. Thank you so much.
Likewise.
Thanks for having me.
Guys, that's been That's been an epic episode of the Let's Just Talk podcast. I've loved it. I hope you have too. I'll see you all next week. Love you all. Bye.